Kenyel Brown, when police informants become serial killers, they gave him a badge. Not a real one, but a shield. A second chance. A promise that if he helped take down the bad guys, his own crimes would be forgotten. But Kenyel Brown didn't stop at walking free. He started killing. Between December 2019 and February 2020, 6 people were murdered in cold blood across Michigan, while Brown was on the government's payroll as a protected informant. His victims were parents, neighbors, business owners. And every time he pulled the trigger, the system that recruited him looked the other way. This is the story of how justice got it wrong, how law enforcement ignored the signs, and how a man they empowered became the very predator they were supposed to stop. Because sometimes, the killer doesn't wear a mask. He wears a deal. Chapter 1. The Deal with the Devil. How Kenyel Brown became untouchable. Before the murders. Before the manhunt. Before the headlines. There was a deal. Kenyel Brown wasn't new to police. His name had been in their files for decades. Weapons charges. Drug busts. Assault. He was the kind of criminal who was always just one bad choice away from a long prison sentence. But somehow, he never stayed locked up. It began in the late 90s. Brown was arrested again and again. By the early 2000s, he had already been tied to a dropped homicide charge. But it wasn't until 2015 that the government saw a different kind of use for him. Behind bars, Brown made a choice. He offered to become an informant. For the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, the ATF, this was routine. Flip a criminal. Feed off their network. Gather intel. Take down someone bigger. So Brown was released. But what made his case different wasn't the deal itself. It was how long the deal protected him, long after his usefulness expired. His job was simple. Listen. Report. Keep officers informed about the flow of drugs and guns in the city. And in return, leniency. But Brown quickly proved unreliable. His tips led nowhere. His behavior was erratic. He failed drug tests. He got caught driving under the influence. He violated parole. Under normal circumstances, those failures would have sent him back to prison. But Brown had a shield. Informant status. No matter how many times he messed up, someone in the system stepped in. And so the cycle repeated. Arrest. Violation. Release. At one point, the ATF decided enough was enough. They cut him loose. But the warning signs, the chaos in his record, didn't travel. Not fast enough. Not to the right people. Because in 2019, the DEA and Detroit Police Department picked him up again. They were hungry for information. And Brown was hungry for freedom. On October 29, 2019, a Detroit police officer signed Kenyel Brown as an informant for a joint DADPD task force. He received a small payment, around $150, a token amount. But the real value was freedom. He was now operating under official protection. Even if his intel was useless, which many in the task force admitted it was, Brown had become untouchable. No one paused to ask why a man with so many recent violations was being trusted again. No one checked why the ATF had walked away from him. And no one realized that this would be the beginning of something far more dangerous than a bad informant. By the end of that year, Kenyel Brown would begin a killing spree. But in October, he was still just a man with a file. A man with a badge of protection. A man who had learned one hard truth. That in Detroit, sometimes the system will protect you, even when it shouldn't. And Brown was ready to take advantage of that truth. At any cost. Chapter 2. The First Shot, Loren Harrington's Last Night. December 7, 2019. River Rouge, Michigan. A cold Saturday evening near the edge of Detroit's city limits. The kind of neighborhood where lights flicker, the sidewalks crack, and silence is rarely peaceful. That night, Loren Harrington would take his final breath, and Kenyel Brown would fire his first known shot in a 3-month killing spree. Loren was 31, a local resident, not a known criminal. He wasn't in the wrong gang or caught in the wrong raid. He was simply in the wrong place, and Brown was looking for blood. Witnesses reported hearing a short argument outside a residence on Electric Street. Then a single gunshot. When police arrived, they found Loren collapsed on the pavement, bleeding from the chest, lifeless. There were no signs of robbery, no gang markings, no personal motive. But within hours, investigators had a suspect, Kenyel Brown. Brown's name came up fast. He had been seen in the area. He had a history of violent behavior. And informally, some officers knew he was on the books. But instead of bringing him in, the case remained open. Brown wasn't even interrogated. Why? Because Brown was still an active informant. His handlers didn't see him as a threat. They saw him as a tool. Inside the system, Brown's value was measured by his connections, not his conduct. Even as his usefulness diminished, his status protected him. The River Rouge homicide didn't shake the foundation. There was no suspension, no hold, no search warrant. Instead, Brown kept moving. For Loren Harrington's family, silence was unbearable. His mother, Tracy, begged for answers. She asked how someone could be murdered in the middle of the street, and no one be held accountable. But she didn't know that behind closed doors, police had already linked a suspect and chosen not to act. This wasn't just about Brown. It was about the ecosystem that let him breathe. One investigator later admitted off record. He slipped through because nobody wanted to shut the door. Everyone thought someone else would handle it. But no one did. And that failure opened the door to more violence. What should have been a wake-up call became a warning ignored. Instead of arrest, Kenyell Brown was paid again for intel. Instead of surveillance, he roamed freely. Instead of being labeled a danger, he remained protected. And so he moved, city to city, connection to connection, until 1 month later, he struck again. Because when Loren Harrington died, no one stopped the man who killed him. Chapter 3. A double homicide no one saw coming. Kimberly Green and Dorian Patterson. January 30th, 2020. The temperature had dropped below freezing in River Rouge. Snow crusted over abandoned cars and rooftops. Inside a modest home on Polk Street, two lives were about to end, and another nearly lost. Kimberly Green was 52. She was a caregiver and community advocate, known for helping neighbors with groceries and transportation. Her partner, Dorian Patterson, age 48, was quiet, polite, and often kept to himself. That Thursday evening, they were relaxing at home when their door opened to a familiar face. Kenyell Brown had been by before. No one heard screaming. No one called in a disturbance. All that was found later was a blood-smeared doorway, three bodies on the floor, and a gun left behind. Kimberly and Dorian were both dead from close-range gunshot wounds. A third victim, Clifton Smith, had also been shot but somehow survived. His injuries were serious, but he lived long enough to speak to police. What he told them was simple and damning. He named the shooter. It was Kenyell Brown. This time, there was no room for doubt. Brown's name was officially tied to a double homicide. But even with a living witness and forensic evidence, there was no immediate arrest. Why? Because Brown was still technically on file as an active informant with the DADPD task force. That would change within days, but the delay was critical. Internal memos reveal that Brown was only deactivated as an informant after his name was connected to the Green-Patterson murders. That decision came not from local outrage, but from fear of public exposure. Brown's handlers had failed to track his movements, failed to monitor his behavior, and now two people were dead. This moment, January 30th, should have triggered a coordinated manhunt. But instead, the system hesitated. A warrant was issued. Alerts were sent out. But Brown was already gone. He disappeared into Detroit's sprawl, a network of vacant homes, disconnected families, and underfunded departments. No one knew where he'd go next. But he did, and he had more killing left to do. Meanwhile, the families of Kimberly Green and Dorian Patterson gathered in mourning. There was no reason for them to die. They weren't involved in criminal activity. They weren't targets of a turf war. They were simply in Brown's way, and Brown, untethered by consequences, pulled the trigger. Kimberly's sister later said in an interview, "The police knew who he was. They knew what he was capable of. So why wasn't he stopped?" That question echoed louder with each passing day. The media had not yet picked up the full pattern. To most, this was still an isolated double homicide. But inside the DPD and DEA offices, the truth was taking shape. They had protected a killer. They had given him time. And now they had blood on their hands. Chapter 4, The Domino Murders, Garcias Woodyard, Amir Thaxton, and Eugene Jennings. After the brutal double homicide of Kimberly Green and Dorian Patterson, Kenyell Brown vanished. But he didn't disappear into silence. He disappeared into motion, fast, violent, and deliberate. In just 3 weeks, three more men would die, each in different neighborhoods, each with no connection to the last, each killed with the same cold finality. The first was Garcius Woodyard, 49 years old. On February 18, 2020, Woodyard was found dead in Highland Park, shot multiple times inside a rundown duplex. He had a history of low-level offenses, but nothing that explained why someone would want him dead. No robbery. No witnesses. No signs of struggle. Only a bullet-ridden body and silence. Less than 48 hours later, Brown struck again. February 20, 2020. Detroit. A small clothing store sat on a corner lot, owned and run by 41-year-old Amir Thaxton. He was known locally for his fashion line, his easy laugh, and his goal of building something for his community. That evening, Brown entered the store under the pretense of shopping. Within minutes, Amir was dead, shot during what police initially suspected was a robbery. But the cash register hadn't been emptied, the door wasn't forced, and there were no signs of panic. Brown had walked in, pulled the trigger, and walked out. By the time detectives linked it to him, he was already gone again. Then came the final known victim. February 22, 2020. Eugene Jennings, age 36, was sitting in his vehicle when Brown approached him. It was a car theft attempt that turned fatal. A single shot through the window. Eugene never saw it coming. With that final killing, the spree reached 6 known victims. 3 in 3 weeks. All while Brown was evading arrest. All while federal agents and local police scrambled to close the gaps they had created. The walls were finally closing in. A pattern had emerged. This wasn't random. It was targeted, deliberate, and reckless. Brown wasn't hiding. He was hunting. And yet, despite everything, the task force hadn't warned the public. His informant status was no longer active, but the fallout from exposing him was just beginning. Internally, officials were panicking. The federal government had opened a review. The media had begun sniffing around. Families of the dead were demanding accountability. But Brown wasn't reading headlines. He was planning his next move. The city of Detroit had become his camouflage, a maze of boarded buildings, disconnected systems, and unresolved crimes. His face was known to some officers, but not to citizens. Not to the people he was stalking. Garcius, Amir, Eugene. 3 men, 3 different lives, all extinguished before the public ever heard his name. Brown wasn't a mystery. He was a mistake the system couldn't admit. And now, with pressure mounting and a manhunt underway, the next chapter in this nightmare would begin. It started with a phone call from a bookstore, and ended with a gunshot in the dark. Chapter 5, The Manhunt and the Backyard Bullet, Brown's final act. By late February 2020, Kenyell Brown had become a ghost with a kill count. 6 people were dead, their families shattered. Their names added to a trail of blood stretching from River Rouge to Highland Park. And now, finally, law enforcement was closing in. The public still didn't know the full story. The media only had fragments. The term informant hadn't surfaced yet. But internally, the agencies knew. They knew they had a crisis. And they knew the man they had once protected had spiraled far beyond control. What they didn't know was where he was hiding, until a call came in from a small adult bookstore in Oak Park. The store clerk recognized Brown's face. He had seen the alerts, and he didn't hesitate. February 24, 2020. A quiet residential block. No sirens at first, just unmarked cars. Tactical teams creeping through yards and alleys. They had traced Brown to a house nearby, a place where he had been staying off-grid. He wasn't alone, but everyone inside knew why the police had come. Brown ran. He didn't go out the front door. He bolted through the back, cutting across a snow-dusted lawn into a neighboring yard. Officers pursued him, but he was fast and desperate. Then came a sound no one expected. A single gunshot. Brown had turned the weapon on himself. The bullet entered his head, but it didn't kill him. He collapsed in the grass, bleeding, unconscious, and barely clinging to life. Police called in medics. For 4 days, Brown lay comatose in a guarded hospital room. There would be no arrest, no interrogation, no courtroom confession, only silence. On February 28, 2020, Kenyell Brown died from complications caused by the gunshot wound. The killing spree was over, but the reckoning had only just begun. Now that Brown was dead, agencies were forced to confront the truth they had tried to bury. Reporters started asking questions. Internal investigations were launched, and families of the victims demanded to know who had let this happen. The answer was complex, but it always pointed back to the same pattern. Brown had been protected. His role as an informant had shielded him from accountability. His violations had been overlooked. His handlers had lost track of him, and when the violence began, they reacted too slowly. Some officers later admitted off record that they felt something was off about Brown, but no one stopped him, because stopping him would have meant admitting that the system had failed. The backyard where Brown shot himself became a symbol, not of closure, but of consequence. A final act that ended one man's life, but opened a thousand questions. And in the days that followed, Detroit would begin to unravel the weight of that failure. One name, one file, one bloodstained oversight at a time. Chapter 6, Broken Trust, Inside the Fallout, the Cover UPS, and the Federal Probe. Kenyell Brown was dead, but the questions were just beginning. In the days following his suicide, law enforcement agencies across Michigan were under pressure. The families of the victims were demanding answers. The media was circling, and inside police precincts and federal offices, one truth was becoming impossible to ignore. They had protected a killer. The first agency to speak publicly was the Detroit Police Department. Chief James Craig confirmed what many had already suspected, that Brown had been a confidential informant for multiple law enforcement entities. He admitted that there had been gaps in communication, that Brown had been recruited, paid, and trusted, even while violating parole and failing drug tests. But his statement only scratched the surface. The full truth was darker. Brown had worked with the ATF, DEA, and DPD. He had been signed, dropped, and re-signed without full background checks or interagency alerts. When the ATF cut ties with him in 2015, they didn't communicate why. And when DPD picked him up again in 2019, they didn't ask. He was reactivated on October 29th, just 6 weeks before his first known murder. Internal reports showed that Brown had been arrested multiple times while working as an informant for DUIs, drug possession, and violating parole. But each time, those charges were reduced or dropped. He was released again and again, because someone in the system believed his information was worth the risk. Only now, the cost of that risk was measured in bodies. The federal government launched a formal probe into how Brown's status as an informant had been managed and mishandled. Investigators reviewed emails, payment records, parole hearings, and internal memos. What they found was a breakdown of responsibility that ran deep. No one wanted to be the person who lost the asset, so no one stopped him. For the families of the victims, the pain was unbearable. Tracy Harrington, mother of the first victim, Loren, spoke publicly. Did they know where he was? Did they know he was dangerous? Why was he still out here? She wasn't alone. Kimberly Green's sister called it state-sanctioned neglect. And Amir Thaxton's father said, they handed him a pass to keep killing. The anger wasn't just about Brown. It was about the system. A system that had failed to warn the community. A system that valued information more than human lives. A system that kept secrets until it was too late. Inside federal agencies, reforms were promised. Stricter guidelines for informant vetting. New rules for interagency data sharing. Oversight protocols to prevent another Brown from slipping through the cracks. But for many, it was too little too late. The trust was broken. Community leaders called for transparency. Victim advocates demanded full disclosure. And across Michigan, people began to ask, how many more informants are out there? How many more have been protected? How many more are walking free? Because Kenyell Brown wasn't just a murderer. He was a mirror, reflecting everything that can go wrong when a system built to protect becomes a shield for predators. Chapter 7, The Hidden Pattern, When Informants Kill and the System Covers. Kenyell Brown wasn't the first, and he won't be the last. As federal investigators closed the file on Brown's spree, another file opened, one far more troubling. It wasn't just about him. It was about the system that created him. And worse, the pattern it revealed. Across the United States, a chilling truth has been hiding in plain sight. Violent criminals, repeat offenders, even suspected murderers, all given second chances, third chances, immunity deals, in exchange for one thing. Information. In the wake of Brown's case, journalists and watchdog groups began digging. What they found was a network of similar tragedies. Scott Lee Kimball, an FBI informant who committed 4 murders while actively working with agents. He lied about his intel, manipulated investigators, and killed without consequence until it was too late. Walter E. Ellis, the Milwaukee serial killer, also known as the Northside Strangler. He committed multiple violent crimes over decades, some while reportedly cooperating with law enforcement. In both cases, like Brown, Their informant status shielded them. Prosecutors looked the other way. Officers ignored red flags. Agencies protected assets, even when it meant putting the public at risk. The Brown case forced a national reckoning. Media headlines shifted from local failure to systemic risk. Think tanks and civil rights groups began demanding that the U.S. government release data on all known violent informants. Some lawmakers introduced legislation to regulate informant use more strictly, including background checks, accountability systems, and civilian review boards. But the truth is hard to legislate, because the informant system was never designed for transparency. It was built in the shadows for use in drug wars, gang infiltration, and undercover investigations. What began as a tactical tool slowly evolved into an ethical blind spot, and Brown was a symptom of that disease. Back in Michigan, the families of his victims remained scarred. No arrests, no trial, no justice. Just six bodies and a shooter who died before ever facing a courtroom. They ask themselves the same question that echoes across every city where this happens. If he wasn't an informant, would he have been stopped? The answer, painful as it is yes. Kenyell Brown's name may not appear in history books, but his story has already changed how communities view justice, how agencies view trust, and how the public views the price of silence. Because when the system values information over life, when no one asks the hard questions, when criminals wear cooperation as a disguise, then what happened in Detroit becomes more than a tragedy. It becomes a warning.